There's so many governments across the world that are either unwilling to or cannot, for different reasons, begin to address a problem in a comprehensive, wide-ranging, solid manner, for lack of a better way to put it. For example, they don't even talk to the local people. There's a paternalistic thing that we will decide what is best for you, as opposed to having a really comprehensive dialogue with local people as to what are their aspirations. Tribal or otherwise, doesn't matter.
Welcome back to another episode of Politics, Ecology, and Everything in Between. Hey, this is Rajiv. We are back after a long hiatus, DJ and I. For this discussion, we picked a very interesting topic. Who is a tribal? A tribal is a very interesting term. Was Tarzan a tribal? The very image of a noble savage. Or is it an invented term? And how is it relevant today? To answer all these questions, we have my good friend, DJ. Hey, DJ, welcome back to episode number 3.
Thank you. Good to be back.
It's an interesting topic that you've suggested for this episode, is being tribal in India. And I never actually considered myself a tribal before. But once you said this statement, being tribal in India, so I went and read some news reports and figured out what exactly is out there and what is the definition of a tribal. So there's this article that I'm reading in the Hindu Online, where they're referencing a Supreme Court judgment, where interestingly, it's a bench comprising of Justice Markandeya Kadju. I'm not sure if he's related to you.
He's my dad's younger brother.
Really? Oh my God. No wonder the apple didn't fall far from the tree. He's very outspoken.
I will refrain from further comment, but yes, he is most definitely outspoken.
Amazing, man. It's mind-blowing. I never knew that connection. Anyway, talking about this, he says that if North America is the land of new immigrants, India is a land of old immigrants, because people have been coming into this country for tens of thousands of years, and we all make up or descendants from various such immigrants. So for example, this book, in Early Indians by Tony Joseph, he says that India is not like a melting pot, like how it is in the US, but more of like a pizza with various toppings. And so like it's the toppings are bunched together in some areas and stuff like that. So there's a base who's the original Indians and then people who came in and settled in different parts of the country. So what I was saying is, before the Brits took over, like the East India Company and so on, I don't think there was any distinctions between you are a tribal and I am not kind of a thing. There was no like, you are a tribe, I'm a city dweller, I'm this, I'm that, or some kind of a distinction. It was only after the Brits came in and they had this whole divide and rule policy, and they made all these groups, and then it kind of passed on to independent India. Is that how it happened?
That's a pretty decent summarization of what it means to be, how the tribal slot or the tribal category or the classification came to be. So, I mean, the starting point, like you said, is the colonial era, because it's that phase of governance across the globe, not just India, that laid the foundation for the thinking of people as being tribal. And in the Indian context, the term arose from notions of such communities that are called tribal as mainly inhabiting remote wild areas such as forests, living in isolated, closed social groups, practicing animistic religion, and conducting or carrying out very simplistic, unsophisticated agriculture, mainly shifting or slash and burn type cultivation, and not possessing written scripts, and overall being primitive people. So that's where it comes from. That is a highly problematic ideology that is the forms of basis, sadly, of this stuff. So it's very important to identify that right at the very onset. Now, interestingly, these communities that were called tribal or considered tribal by the colonial administration across the globe, they were simultaneously described in excessively virtuous or idealistic terms as well. For example, they were thought of as being noble, independent, honest, simple, and having some sort of special connection with nature. Now, the result of all this kind of thinking and this ideology was a production of a noble savage construct, right? That stood in stark contrast to the civilized European. So you have the primitive yet noble savage, and then you have the civilized urban European. So that was the contrast. This is loosely what is described as social evolutionist thinking, which was in back in those days in the, I guess, 1800s and 1800s. I'm not sure exactly which date, but during those times, it was a core of the anthropological thinking of its time. Anthropology has since disavowed it, discarded it, but it still persists in modern day administrations, which used to be colonial in the past. From an administrative standpoint, because of such ideologies or such patronizing stereotypes, tribal people were viewed as always in need of protection and improvement because it was felt that they were incapable of looking out for their own political interests and their own development. So that is where it all comes from, this deeply problematic ideological framework.
Okay, so how did the whole classification come about? How did they decide this guy is a scheduled tribe, this guy is not a scheduled tribe? What is the classification like? Does it naturally mean backward?
You know, interestingly, the solidification of the tribal category happened post-independence. It was the post-independence Indian government and the Indian constitution that uncritically adopted the colonial concept of the tribe and through what was the Government of India Act of 1935, and then made it into law through the creation of a formal category, the Scheduled Tribe, and then bound that category with specific demarcated geographic space. So, for example, Nagaland for the Nagas, Mizoram for the Mizos, Boroland for the Boros, in the case of my own research. That is what is so interesting, that the colonial powers didn't quite harden the category the way that post-independence India has done. The whole underlying logic for the colonial administration was that when they established control over various parts of the subcontinent, they typically encountered vast areas with the potential for generating revenue and resources from a diversity of options. For example, in Western Assam, which is where I did my own research, the conversion of forests to agricultural production, such as food crops, such as rice, and cash crops, such as tea and jute, that happened. Then they wanted to extract timber from forest ecosystems, and therefore, in order to do that, they established control over vast swaths of forested land and labeled them as reserve forests that were meant exclusively for the production of timber, which local people couldn't quite access. These were all areas that local people, including tribal and non-tribal communities, had been accessing for millennia, right? So suddenly, you know, tribal people, for example, could not access resources that they had been doing for years and years. And the need for this kind of control was that the British encountered often very intricate, complicated systems of politics and economics and local markets that they wanted to gain control over. So in order to gain effective control over these systems, their whole motivation was to simplify it. Simplify it so they could administratively control it better and more efficiently extract resources, both in the term of actual commodities as well as revenue from land. Because ultimately, land is the prime commodity. From land comes everything. Timber, agriculture, tea, other kinds of forest products, revenue, and trading systems and credit systems, everything comes from ultimately land. That is what was the prime motivation of the colonial administration to gain control over these systems. And then what they did was, because the way they understood so-called tribal communities as being primitive, wild, savage, they tried to basically restrict them to particular areas. Even though they might have roamed widely over the entire northeast region of India, for example, but now they were to be restricted to particular parcels of land. And so restricting particular communities to particular areas of land is what the Indian government has continued. And it has created often a whole host of problems and complications that the Indian government and local state governments are dealing with in the form of separatist movements, in the form of like attempts to control land and resources and so on and so forth.
But is there any similar equivalent in North America? Is there a difference in the way Native Americans are treated in the US versus Native Americans being treated in Canada?
I don't have enough knowledge to effectively compare the treatment of Native Americans in Canada versus the United States. What I will say, though, is that like as far as labeling people as a certain tribe, Apache or Comanche or Navajo, whatever it might be, it is always accompanied by restricting them to particular spaces which are called reservations.
Right.
Now, reservations can vary in size, but basically what it means is that is where the Native American is supposed to reside, be limited to. And then the whole governance system of reservations is very interesting, but it is similar in the sense that ethnicity, ethnic identity is restricted to particular parcels of land.
Right. But like, if you take India, for example, you have so many sects, leave alone the tribals. You have backward castes, most backward castes, other backward castes, so on and so forth. You know, where did all those guys come from? And since you have 60, 70 years of independence now, and economically, so many people have migrated out of those specific areas that you're talking about, but they still carry the tribal identification. They moved out of those areas. Their economic stature has changed. So many generations have passed, but they still carry that identification of a tribal. How does that work?
So, you know, a very good place to start as far as current realities of being tribal in India is to visit the Ministry of Tribal Affairs of India, that ministry's website. And if you go there, they to this day list the characteristics or the criteria by which a scheduled tribe is labeled as such. And I'm reading this directly from the website. They have, number one, primitive traits. Number two, geographical isolation. Number three, distinct culture. Number four, and this is the really interesting one, shyness of contact. I'm not even quite sure what that means. How do you decide who is shy of contact? To what extent? What are the basis for that decision? I don't know. And number five, that the community at large is backward.
What is backward?
Exactly. So now let's start with that. The basic approach and the administrative approach towards designating people as scheduled tribes, or for that matter, backward castes, is riddled with inconsistencies. You can find this in many parts of India, that two communities that are very close to each other culturally, linguistically, and have lived with, traded with, been very culturally close to each other, and even, like I said, linguistically close to each other, it'll often happen that one community is designated as a scheduled tribe and the other one is not. Like I said, inconsistency. And there's bound to be inconsistency when you are not even clear as to what your criteria actually mean. Like, what is shyness of contact? There's no other way to put it but use the term ridiculous, because first of all, how do you decide whether somebody is shy or not? And then a whole community, an entire group of thousands, if not millions of people are all shy? I mean, we all know from our own experience that like these kind of traits, they vary within a family. Like the brother might be shy while the sister is not. And I'm just using very informal reasoning. But the point is that this is because of the kind of ideas from which this category emanates. Because those ideas are riddled with inconsistencies and problems, and that I saw myself in my study area. For example, there were these community called the Koch Rajbanshis. The Koch Rajbanshis are very similar culturally and ethnically to the Boros, but the Boros are classified as a scheduled tribe, while the Koch Rajbanshis are not. And the Koch Rajbanshis are fighting to get that category. And the reason for that, as you mentioned again, is what is known as affirmative action in the United States. The reservation system, that is a form of affirmative action, right? That if you belong to a certain category that is perceived as being historically marginalized, and you provide the administrative means to disproportionately give resources, power to that community so they can actually so-called lift themselves up, and for the reason of equitability and fairness. But then, like you said, where do you draw the line? Supposing a family that belongs to a scheduled tribe category, they have been urbanites and quite well-to-do and educated by Indian standards for the last three or four generations, then should they be asking for affirmative action? And that is a very good question, because a lot of that is happening.
Yeah, I think that's a really touchy political subject.
So which is why the whole reality of being tribal in India is riddled with controversy, riddled with political turmoil and conflict. And for these kind of reasons, because much of it comes from problematic categorization, and even before that, problematic ideologies.
Right.
The Indian government often is unwilling or incapable of providing the appropriate resources and the appropriate support to a given community or a given area to help people realize their potential, whatever they want. It could be infrastructure, it could be educational infrastructure, it could be power, energy, whatever it might be. It is unable to do so or is unwilling to do so for whatever sets of reasons. And therefore, that community is in dire straits. Now, there's many non-tribal communities that are suffering the same kind of problems that tribal communities are. So those communities are like, we are poor too. We are marginalized as well. Why are we not getting some affirmative action? So you see, so which is exactly why this category is so riddled with turmoil.
So yeah, so I think the whole question about who's marginalized, and if they are marginalized and they are uplifted, and for 2-3 generations, they don't even consider themselves tribal, if not for name only, then what do you do with them? So should this be applied only if they're in specific areas, and once they leave that area, they lose their tribal status?
This is often what happens. You see, it is as complicated and conflict-ridden as an example that I'll give you. There's another, just like Boroland is a sort of area within the state of Assam where the Boros have disproportionate power and control over the governance, over the land, over the politics. Just like that, there's a similar area which is semi-autonomous, just like the Boros are, for another tribe called the Karbis in Assam. And Boro, if he moves to a Karbi, to the Karbi semi-autonomous region, he loses his scheduled tribe rights, which is ridiculous. I mean, if you are classified as a scheduled tribe primarily because you're viewed as being marginalized, you're marginalized no matter where you go. I mean, your marginalization should be evaluated on the basis of your income, resources, and institutional support you have, and so on and so forth. There could be other ways of measuring it, not just arbitrarily, that, you know, if you're in one area, you're a tribal, and if you go to another area, you lose that tribal status, right? Now, similarly, there are many communities which are classified as being tribal in other parts, in neighboring states or close by to Assam, who were transported during colonial times as indentured labor in tea plantations. And many of those communities who are today classified as tribal in the states of their origin do not have the scheduled tribe status in Assam. And they're fighting for that. And Boro and other tribals are objecting to their getting the scheduled tribe status. So you see, so there is a lot of political complication woven into this category. It raises a number of questions. And you see, another point that I wanted to make from a more fundamental perspective is that if you consider people living in rural areas and forested land, hunting, doing a bit of agriculture, and maybe dressing in a certain way as being tribal, then we all were tribal at some point in our ancestry.
Exactly.
That is how most human beings lived. This creates all kinds of problematic and complicated and conflicted identities, which often create tensions and sometimes even outright conflict that India and many other countries are seeing in the world right now.
But I think fundamentally, like you said, we are all tribal in some shape or form.
If you consider the current criteria by which people are called tribals, then we could all meet that criteria at some point in our ancestry. If there's one reality of the human species that is almost universal and that is very relevant to this whole discussion, it is that we, most of us, if not all of us, are immigrants. I mean, from the current understanding, it's like we all moved out of Africa. We all originated in Africa and then moved out from there. So we all are immigrants. So there's nobody who just sprang out of the soil. Maybe in Africa they did. They just originated in that land. But in every other part of the world, you could make the claim based on current evidence that we all are immigrants. Even Native Americans, they crossed over from Asia into the North American continent and then spread to South America. So we all are immigrants. So the other term that is used in most of the world, and especially the international stages, indigenous people, which is essentially a conceptual, ideological way and theoretical way consistent with the term the tribal category in India. And a lot of tribal communities are trying to now engage with the international indigenous movement to gain more political power from that. So it is very interesting in that tribal people, not just in India, but all over the world, have a sort of a complicated relationship with the word tribal or the tribal category or the indigenous category. At some level, they are a little uncomfortable with it because it labels them as being primitive and savage and jungle dwelling or whatever it might be. But yet at the same time, it gives them all kinds of political power within the systems that they live in. So they have a sort of a conflicted, complicated relationship with that category.
Yeah, but what's the way out then? Are there any movements that's trying to fix this problem?
You know, see, the thing is that when you think of fixing a problem, then you first have to understand what the problem is. And if the problem, if the issue becomes complicated, becomes progressively harder to find simplistic solutions to that particular issue or problem. Because this political area is so riddled with conflicts, tensions, and political dynamics, that there's no easy solution. Because before we even begin to discuss potential solutions to whatever problem that might arise from such categorization, we have to fully understand and agree upon what the category even means. And there are many social scientists who make the claim, and with good evidence, with very solid evidence, that essentially this category is not standing on any firm ground, theoretical ground. It is sort of an invented thing. Look, you could argue that almost all culture is invented and it has all kinds of hard and soft areas. Some are easy to defend, some aspects of it are not so easy to defend. But the reality is that these categories are now woven into the lives, the politics, the livelihoods of people. So once that has happened, it's very hard to then disentangle or remove it from the system, so to speak. Because if you do so, you might generate other issues.
It's kind of a damned if you do, damned if you don't kind of a thing, you know?
Precisely, because it's to do with people's lives. And look, the thing is that very few governments have the resources to begin to really comprehensively and carefully reassess issue.
So kind of close this conversation, what is the ecological impact of this problem? We have these marginalized groups living in the periphery of these reserve forests, and they lose access to these areas, which was traditionally their source of income. And because of this, it creates conflict, insurgency, etc., etc. So what did you see in your research? Because of these flawed, inconsistent policies of the government, how does that impact the ecology or the environment?
See, as far as the environment is concerned, to put it quite simply, one of the biggest problems that post-independence India continues to face to this day is that the administrative system that it started with in 1947 when it got independence is pretty much the same system that the colonial administration put in place. Now, the difference is that post-independence, the country calls itself a secular democratic nation, right? While the administrative system that the colonial powers put in place was done so with a single primary objective, that is to extract resources most efficiently from the subcontinent. So that obviously, when you want to do that, you have a disproportionate amount of power within the center, right? So today, that would be Delhi. And the local states, the local areas, which are the states, to this day complain about not having enough power and control over their own lives and their own resources. So that is one of the main problems. And still, to this day, for example, reserve forests, which the colonial government put in place to extract timber from, was land that was taken without any discussion, without any consultation with local communities. Very often, people were driven out of forests, and then that land was demarcated as a reserve forest. Because of all these historical injustices, 2006 Act, God, I forget the exact title of the act, but basically it's called the Forest Rights Act in lay terms, in common usage. And the Forest Rights Act is basically to give, the whole idea is that if people have been chased out of reserve forests by the colonial administration, they get proof that they used to live there and make a livelihood over there, then they can get back their land. So again, you can immediately see how this whole process could be riddled with all kinds of inaccuracies and problems. Where do you have the records? Were the records accurately maintained? And sometimes the records are missing. And there are all kinds of other political interests which can shift the whole argument in different ways, or even the implementation of the act on the ground. You know, that's a whole other story. So the point being that you have these sort of efforts to give so-called tribal people access to the lands that they claim they had before the colonial administration came. But there's no easy way, because like the Forest Department, which is the government arm that is controlling the forested ecosystems of the country, is very reluctant to give up power and control over these resources. There's a lot of ongoing tension and conflict. Even this legal reality does not often guarantee land rights to tribal communities. You could see academic and journalistic reports about all the problems that are associated with how the act is actually being implemented on the ground. When it comes to the environment, obviously, it's what happens on a given piece of land is driven by so many different things at the same time. You can't just consider environmental change or environmental issues just in terms of tribal people, for example. You have to consider local economies, infrastructure, transport, local politics, local sociocultural dynamics, all of these things at the same time. The whole tribal identity and a certain at a particular tribal movement in Boro land is definitely playing a major role in the governance of, you know, land that might be of interest for biodiversity conservation, for example.
Yeah, it's an interesting question, because I think indigenous communities are asking the same questions world over. The dispossessed land, they want it back, and it's happening with the Native American communities. It's happening here in New Zealand. So they're fighting to get back control of the land they lost.
I think one of the problems is, and this is just not true, this applies not to just tribal people, but in general, there's so many governments across the world that are either unwilling to or cannot, for different reasons, begin to address a problem in a comprehensive, wide-ranging, solid manner, for lack of a better way to put it. For example, they don't even talk to the local people. There's a paternalistic thing that we will decide what is best for you, as opposed to having a really comprehensive dialogue with local people as to what are their aspirations. Tribal or otherwise, doesn't matter. Like I said, all human beings, whether they're tribal or not, they often have the same aspirations and the same needs and the same desires. They might conceptualize their problems in different ways based on culture and local politics or whatever, but basically the needs and drivers are the same. You would expect that local governments who want to sort of comprehensively address a problem would begin with having a comprehensive dialogue. But even that does not happen. For example, in many parts of India, for sure, the government still, because of the notions of tribal people as being primitive and savage and uncultured and ignorant, they consider it below their dignity to sit with them and have a discussion as equals. So even you can't even begin to have or create a sort of a comprehensive starting and solid starting point from which to begin discussions because of all kinds of reasons. And that is what, you know, happens with typically with marginalized people. If the government, you know, views them as being essentially powerless, then the political powers are even more reluctant to really engage in a comprehensive dialogue with them. Yeah. So these are the kind of problems that a lot of tribal communities face in India. That is part of the reason why they then utilize their tribal identity to try and force the government to do something, for example. But if you really search underneath all that, beneath that tribal political posturing, if you will, you will see that what they're asking for is not very different from what any other non-tribal marginalized group might ask for. But that is the thing, is like, it comes under the same thing. Listen, really listen to what people want. What do they want from you? What do they want from their system?
Yeah, it's like in any relationship.
Absolutely. The fundamentals don't change that often. You know, the fundamentals you know, remain the same. Listen carefully, be empathic.
Yeah, empathetic leadership is very important.
And India is very rare, as you and I both know, to find empathic leadership.
They equate that with weakness.
Empathy does not mean surrendering or not. You can bargain from a position of power and yet be empathic. Those are not mutually exclusive things, you know?
I think that's the big takeaway from this conversation.
It's not a zero-sum game.
No, it is not.
That's the bottom line.
Yeah, so you have to listen and you have to be in their shoes, so as to speak, if you want to have a long-term solution. Otherwise, it'll continue to create problems in the future.
Absolutely.
So on that note, let's end this conversation and this episode, DJ.
Yes. Thank you so much for having me again.
Looking forward to the next one. And hopefully it should be as interesting and fascinating and complicated as this one. And that's a wrap for episode 3. I hope you found this interesting. This is an original podcast from Inscape Media. Please visit inscapemedia.com/podcasts for more information. The next episode is all about EV. Or is it? Catch you in the next one. Till then, stay safe, everyone.